Accession number 12941, Wally Binch, Reel 1.
Mr. Wally Binch, Reel 1. Could you tell me when and where you were born, Mr. Binch?
Yes, I was born, date of birth was 30th of the 6th, 1923. And I was born in Nottingham, I believe Traffic Street in Nottingham.
What did your father do for a living?
My father was a labourer, also some kind of electrician, and during the war he also drove a meat wagon, and he became involved with the job that I had during the war, later on.
And how many of you were there in the family?
I had four brothers, four other brothers, and then my mother adopted a lad called Charlie Baxter. He lost his parents when he was about 9, and my mother took him in, so there's quite a crowd of us.
What do you remember about your childhood? What sort of living conditions were you... I mean, what was it like?
I didn't really like going to school. Not a lot. Hated that, rather. And, the happy days, as far as I can remember. Although... I say happy, I ran away, myself and a fellow called Bernie Taylor. We ran away when I was about 13, for about a month. For about a week. And we got as far as Boston. And then we must have got fed up with it, and either they fixed us back or came back. I can't quite remember.
What made you run away?
Well, I think my dad was getting on to me a bit.
Was he in regular employment? I mean, did you have enough income coming into the house?
I don't think we had a lot, you know. As I say, my dad had jobs at labouring, then he worked for the electricity board, that was it. So he must have been driving for them. It was hard to work now and then. But I don't think we could have been too bad off, because I can remember when I was about 12 or 13, he'd got a car of some kind, an old car. And he used to take us to Skegness and put it out for hire and things like that to make a bit more money.
Now, what about your first school? What was that?
I now recall that the first school I ever went to was a Catholic school called St. Patrick's on London Road. And I went there with my auntie, who's 3 months older than myself, Gladys, nicknamed Sal. And we lasted about a week. And I said one day, come on, Sal, we're not sticking this. Because we didn't like the nuns, you know, in the big long dresses. So we ran away from there. And then after that, my mother sent us to Queen's Drive School, infant school. And must have been there about 5 or 6 years, I suppose.
And what was your sort of secondary school?
The next school was Trentbridge Boys School.
And what kind of an education did you have overall, do you think? I mean, you said you didn't like it much.
No, I didn't care for it a lot, yeah. I didn't appreciate it at all, really. I was glad to get away from it. I left at 14.
Had they given you... You got the 3 R's sorted out, had you?
Well, yes, I learned to read and write, of course. I was in, I started in 1A, 2B, and then left in 3A. I went down 1 year, for some reason or other, yeah. Well, just not good enough. I can't say they weren't the happiest days of my life.
What about your work? Did you take any part-time jobs before you left school?
Yes, I was delivering papers at West Bridgeford morning and night. I'm trying to remember how much we got a week. It might have been 5 shillings a week, something like that, for both the two, or it might have been 3. I can remember, the thing I do remember is there were big heavy papers, especially on Saturday mornings. And then Saturday nights we used to get paid, and we used to come to a cafe on Trent Bridge and have 6 penny worth of stale cakes, you know, and that used to be a highlight of our week. That was, yeah, so we enjoyed that. I can also remember the very, very cold mornings, frostbite, and still having to do it. And then off to school. But of course, kids do that today, just the same, don't they? Yeah.
Any other part-time jobs before you left school?
The only thing we ever did was Saturday mornings, we'd go around the shops on Arkwright Street asking for empty boxes, wooden boxes, and we used to go around selling the wood, tuppence a bucket, to the bigger houses on Queen's Drive, all around there, and make a little bit. That's about the only thing we did, selling firewood, Saturday mornings.
Now, what about when you left school? What was your first job?
Now, my first job was an errand boy at a greengrocer's shop at West Bridgford. That didn't last long. Then I moved on from there to Redgate, which was a bottling plant, and they bottled soft drinks. And I remember now they also bottled Guinness, because some of my time was spent picking up the Guinness bottles, shaking them because of the sediment in them, and putting them back again. Bottle after bottle after bottle after bottle, you know. One of the nice things about that job was that you could drink as much ice cream soda as you like, or cream soda, yeah. Well, any of the bottle things, they didn't mind you drinking it.
And about what year, when did you finish at Redgate's?
I think I must have had about 9 months there. Because I then moved on from there to a firm called Hallam & Son, H. Hallam & Son, bar fitters. And I became an errand boy, come warehouseman in there. And I remember I was there when war was declared, definitely, because we'd got glasses still coming from Czechoslovakia. Yeah, and we still had glasses, things like that.
So that was your job. Now, to duck back a bit, so to speak, like, because something that's going to be apparent in the interview is this business about the ukulele and playing the ukulele and that sort of thing.
Oh,
when did that start?
Well, I saw the advert. I'd seen George Formby on the films, obviously, you know, liked him like everybody else did. Saw the advert in a book to send so much a week for a wooden ukulele, which I think was about 4 and 6 pence. So I sent my 9 pence a week, or whatever it was, and eventually got the ukulele, got hold of a George Formby record or two. I used to play them slow, and then pick up the old ukulele. Now, this is the one I've got in my hand, the wooden ute. This is just about the same sort. Our dog's got fleas. And I used to try and pick up the songs, and one of the first ones was Oh Mr. Will, what shall I do? I've got those kind of black mouse Chinese laundry blues. This funny feeling come through me stealing, makes me so I don't know what to do. Oh Mr. Will, and so on. And the thing that I was trying to do was get this special Formby stroke, which sounded like this. And I spent hours and hours with the records slowed down trying to pick up that stroke. And then, of course, I went and saw George Formby on the pictures, and I heard this famous sound again. But, of course, he wasn't playing it the way I played it. His hands were going all over the place, and it wasn't until many years later when, with the aid of video, I was able to discover that George Formby had been miming all the time. And I was trying to imitate it. I was trying to do something that was impossible. But in the meantime, it let me to play the ukulele quite well. And so with the uke...
The war?
This is before the war, yes.
So about what age would you be when you took it up?
I think about 12, 13, something like that, yes, with the ukulele, yes. And then learned to play the ukulele, and eventually we used to go into the pubs and play the uke and sing the George Formby songs. I didn't quite understand all the words, but I used to get big laughs with it. And then they used to go around with the hat. And so I was earning money by the time I was about 14 in pubs, you know, now and then. And then I do remember the first time that I ever sang into a microphone. That was a real thrill for me. We went to a club called, I think it was Brownie's Bookies Club, or the Crescent Club. And there was a microphone, and what a thrill to hear yourself on the mic and the pianist at the back of you. It was great. And eventually that led on to me joining the Military Entertainers Unit.
I'll come back to that then. So yes. What do you remember about the actual... were you expecting the declaration of war? Did you take any interest in foreign affairs and things at all?
Yes, when I worked at Hallam & Sons, there was a fellow there called Sam. And he had the Daily Worker every day. And, of course, he gave me my ears a-mashing about what was going to happen and why things were all wrong. And he kept saying there was going to be a war and all that sort of thing. So, we're more or less... Well, I knew, of course, as well, because in 1938, on Queen's Drive, which was near the school, they dug trenches all along the Queen's Drive there in preparation for war. So we thought something was going to happen then.
What about the actual declaration of war? Do you remember that day at all?
Yes, I remember that day. I was in Northcote Terrace, and we heard the broadcasts, and it seemed to me not very long at all. We went out, a sunny day, and the sirens went, and we all were looking for aeroplanes. We didn't see anything. But we thought, oh, this is it, we're going to get bombed, because everybody had heard stories about the bombers were going to come over and knock hell out of us, but nothing happened. Yes, I do remember that day.
Now, you'd be about 16 and a half when the war started.
Yes, thank God, yeah. Yes.
Did you think it would affect you at all? I mean, were you expecting it to go on a long time and you'd be called up eventually, or what?
I think I was excited by the thought of there being a war and that, and all the strange things that were happening, you know, air raid wardens and blackouts, and but I was starting to enjoy my youth at that time, you know, so I don't think I thought too much about it. And then eventually,
So how did you... You mentioned the Home Guard for Military Entertainers. How did you get into that? And what was it? Because I've not heard of that before.
First of all, I'd started playing the ukulele and then getting paid proper money, 12 and sixpence, for doing perhaps three or four spots at local clubs, the Montpelier Road Club, Dunkirk, and the Triangle Club at Ilkeston. I remember I appeared at both of those. And then I went on one or two Sunday shows where they had a film show and then they had a variety show as well. And... They were free, by the way, for charity. And then I got to know one or two of the local artists, and then I heard they'd formed this unit. I believe it was run by the council, and it was called the Military Entertainers Unit. And there were local club acts, and they would be taken in vehicles to go and entertain troops out at searchlight matches and all sorts of things like that. And in other words, we were sort of a form of ENSA, but run by the council.
And no formal connection with the army via the Home Guard then? It was just sort of...
No. I did join the Home Guard later, by the way.
So what would a typical do be like then when you went out with the Military Entertainers Unit? Do you remember one in particular you could tell us about, or could you give us a typical one made up of a variety of a few of them?
Well, I do remember one in particular, but it's probably jumping the story a bit, because it was the one that made me join the army.
Right, we'll come back to that.
We'll
then.
Come back to that, yes.
Mainly,
it would be about four acts going out. A singer, a comedian. There was a great comedian called Fred Hesketh. He used to take his teeth out and sing, "I'm not all there, there's something missing." Great, yeah. And, of course, ukulele players abounded. There's always one or two ukulele players. And sopranos. And of course, the singers were all straight singers. You know, they're all tenors. Baritones, yeah, the real McCoy.
And how did the troops respond? Because they're not always good audiences.
Well, we found them great audiences. You know, they loved it. You know, it was something to. I think they did like it, as far as I'm concerned.
And they liked all the acts equally, or would they have a favourite? I mean,
I can't remember exactly how everybody went down, but I would have said we all went down fairly well, because if anybody I kept going and didn't go down fairly well, he stopped going. Yeah.
And about how long would the show be, usually?
I would think about a couple of hours, usually, you know, something like that, yeah.
Was there drink there? I mean, would there be wet?
There definitely was drinks there, yes, I do remember that, yeah.
Had you started to drink then? You were a bit underage, but...
Yes, I had, yes. Well, I'd started drinking probably from about 15, because my dad then, who was a drummer, he realised that this was popular in the local pub, so he used to take me in, and we used to go in Sunday lunchtime or Saturday night, and he'd have his drumsticks up his sleeve, and when things started to go out, would come the drumsticks, and I'd be singing the George Formby songs. And, yeah, so I did get drink. Yes, I would say I was drinking from about the age of 15, if not slightly before.
Well, did your father encourage you with your music then, as an old drummer?
Yes, oh yes. Once he realised it was popular and it was going well, yes, he did. Yes, he liked it.
Did any of your brothers play anything?
Yeah, I had a brother that played the drums as well. I come more or less from a drumming family. Uncle George was in the First War, and I remember a photograph of him on a horse with big drums at the side. My Uncle Joe played in the Theatre Royal, drums and timpani. My Uncle Sis played in the South Notts Hussars, I do believe. My dad was a drummer, and my brother was a drummer. Used both hands to play the ukulele. But the other brothers, the other three brothers, they didn't bother at all.
Had you not been tempted by the drums with all these drummers about?
Well, my Uncle Joe had tried to teach me, but I just hadn't got the patience to do the double flam. So my younger brother took the drums on then, yeah. Yeah, that's right, yes. I'm just checking that I'd got three other brothers besides, that's right, yeah.
So, how else did the war affect your life during 1939-40?
Well, I eventually left H. Hallam & Sons and got a job with the... I think it was called a wholesale and retail meat agents. It was an agency for allocating meat to the retail butchers, you see. And... our job was to get to the abattoir about 4:30 every morning.
Where would that be?
That would be on Meadow Lane, at the cattle market, at the Meadow Lane at Nottingham. And we'd get there, and the meat would be there. It would be weighed. My job was to write the weight on the ticket and stab the side of beef with a little sword, inch high, 2 inches high, you know, a little sword to keep the thing on there. And then that would take us up to about 9 o'clock. And then we would retire to the officers with ready reckoners, and I would be helping then to make the bills out until about dinner time, and that was the end of our working day. And while I was there, I met a drummer there called Jim Wright, and there was also a saxophonist there, and we formed a little band and did one or two little gigs, you know, even there, sort of thing. So we enjoyed that as well.
Now, this was part of the rationing thing, so each butcher would only be allowed so much meat. They couldn't just order what they wanted.
No, that's right. They would be allowed so much. These were sides of beef at the abattoir. And on a place called Pennyfoot Street, which was off London Road, there was a frozen store where they had carcasses of lambs, you know. And so they were allowed so much frozen meat from Australia and things like that, you see. And I do recall now that my dad then, by this time, had got a job driving for some butcher, Dewhurst, the butcher was, and sometimes in the afternoons I would go out with him and get a bit of practice in on the size of beef, which weighed quite a lot. But the butchers were all very good to me, you know, they all treated me, yeah.
Were you aware of the black market, or was there a black market in Nottingham for meat?
There would be a black market, I suppose, but I wasn't aware of any of that, no. I've got no connections with anything like that. But from what I understand, when I got back at our house, they never went short of anything, you know, regarding meat and that, because he was one of those delivering it, you see, so he'd be, obviously, be all right for meat.
Did you mind the work? Connected with abattoirs, were you squeamish at all with it?
Well, not at all, because one thing I hadn't told you was that on my way home from Queen's Drive School, I would go to my grandmother's on Traffic Street, and she lived exactly opposite Furnaces, where they slaughtered all the pigs. and we would wander down and stand there watching them cutting the throats of pigs and squealing, and it didn't seem to bother us. We got used to it, you see. So I don't suppose the abattoir bothered me at all. No, it didn't bother me at all, no.
Now, when did you join the Home Guard?
Well, this would be while I was at the abattoir, and I think I would have been in it about 3 months before I joined the army. Well, I joined the army in January, so I would have joined it about October.
Now,
October 1914.
What made you join the Home Guard?
What made me? Well, it was the thing to do. Get in and... that's all I can remember, yeah, that I wanted to do it and...
Where did you go to sign up for it? Do you know which battalion you were in?
No, the only recollections I have of the Home Guard is standing guard at the abattoir gates and being on parade inside the cattle market, doing Sunday morning parades, things like that. That's about all.
Did they give you any worthwhile training?
Not really, no. Not as far. I don't... I've not thought about this for a long while, but when I think about this, I can't have been in... Probably wasn't in 3 months. Perhaps as little as 6 weeks or a month, something like that, before I joined. But I've no memories of it except in parading and in the foot drill. We may have done something with rifles. And then, well, we did, because we were standing guard at the abattoir. So it was a rather limited Home Guard period.
Were there any air raids on Nottingham that you remember during that period?
Yes, I do recall. I remember I was down by the Nottingham County ground. I had a girlfriend then, the only one I ever had, called Betty Johnson. And we were just walking by the Nottingham County ground when suddenly the sirens had gone. It was blackout, of course. And then we heard the crump of bombs. And it sounded to us just as though it had dropped where she lived, which was Brierley Street, which was near Queen's Drive School. And we went dashing down there, but it hadn't dropped anywhere near there. It was an illusion to drop somewhere else. And there were about 3 or 4 bombs dropped that night.
Do you remember the air raid precautions that were taken?
Air raid precautions?
Starting perhaps with the blackout, I mean... Was that properly observed in your house?
As far as I know, yes, we always observed the blackout, yes. I can remember it being very dark. I can remember the buses had got these little slits on. You could hardly see where you were going. And I can remember quite a few people banging into things during the blackouts. And we blacked our house out, all right.
Yes. What did you use?
It was some material they bought from shops, blackout material, as far as I can recall, yeah. And it sort of came down every night, yeah, just blacked out.
What about air raid shelters or precautions in the house?
Yeah, you know? Well, we in the house, all we could do, all we did, I remember one night... We got a cubby hole under the stairs, and we got under that, in that. Outside, in the terrace, there was a brick-built shelter. It wasn't an Anderson shelter, it was a street shelter of some kind. The Anderson shelters were the tin ones, weren't they? Yeah. But this was a brick-built shelter. We never went in there.
Did some people go up? I mean,
some people, yeah, I believe some people did, yes, we didn't. We just, in fact, some nights we would just, when the bombs came out, instead of sheltering, we would be standing out there looking to see what we could see, you know, of Jerry and that. I do remember talking about the Queen's Drive, digging the slit trenches. Then about 1939 or just after, they had oil drums along Queen's Drive and they used to set fire to them every night.
What
to
for?
To create smoke. I can remember that, yeah. It was quite smoky. Mm.
Now, I think the next thing is this concert you did that made you decide to join the army. Could you tell us in as much detail as possible what happened that night? Yeah.
Well, I was, as I say, about 17 and a half. I was enjoying life because I got a girlfriend, I was going out entertaining people at night, and that made me happy. And then I was going along okay. Then we went to do this show to entertain a searchlight battery on somewhere along Wilford Hill. And we went along there, and I remember Betty Johnson was with me, and we entertained the lads, and everybody was having a good time. They got beer. Then suddenly the sirens went, and the sirens had gone, and there was a command of some sort given to the lads, and they knocked the beer over, they dashed out to the guns, the searchlights went up, they manned the guns, and it really excited me, and I thought to myself, oh, this is the life for me. So the next day, without telling anybody, I went to London Road and said I want to volunteer to join the army. Right, how old are you? 17 and a half. Oh, well, you better come back when you're 18. So I waited about a couple of days and then went back to London Road. I want to join the army. How old are you? 18. Right. And they took particulars and they asked me what I wanted to join. And do you want to join this? Do you want to join that? Do you want so-and-so? And the name Sherwood Foresters seemed to be quite the most romantic thing to me. So I said, oh, the Sherwood Foresters. And then I went home. And I got my calling up notification sometime later.
So when did you actually... Do you remember the date you joined up or the date you were called up from that?
Well, I remember it because I've sent to the army to find out when it was, and it was the January the 22nd, 1941. I remember I got up very early that morning, and about 4 o'clock, and I'd got to be there, I think, for about 6 o'clock. Incidentally, London Road was only about 800 yards from where I lived on Kirkwhite Street, so I hadn't got far to go. And my dad got wind of this, he got up early with me, and I don't know whether I'd really told him I was going. And then he found out I was going to join the army, and he really got on to me. And as I walked up Kirkwhite Street, he threw stones at me, you rotten bugger, leaving your mother at a time like this. And almost until I got round the corner to London Road.
Actually throwing stones,
yeah, that was my introduction to it. But nevertheless, I went there and I got the King's Shilling, I believe, and they whisked me off to Dolphin Street Schools, which was not too far away, and they kitted me up. And that night, strangely enough, I came home the same night in uniform, which... doesn't sound to be true, but it really is. And I can't remember whether all was forgiven or not, but I came home anyway.
What did they kit you out with that first time?
Well, none of it fitted, I know that. But I'd got an overcoat and some kind. So it'd be a battle dress, an overcoat and a battle dress.
And you say it didn't fit the stuff?
Well, not really, no. I think they said you'll grow into it. I went from there to Dolphin. I joined up and I went from there to a place called Dolphin Street Schools, which is on Waverley Street at Nottingham. And that was the 70th, I found out that I was part of the 70th Battalion, Sherwood Foresters, which I found out later was a young soldiers battalion. And what I remember of that place, when I think of Dolphin Street, I think of palliasses on the floor. We all caught the flu. We marched around the corner to Raleigh Street, where I learned about dining out, you know, in company for the first time. You know, only ever eaten at home before.